This morning, I'm going to be talking about the seventh principle that you'll find on our list of principles over there. It's the last one. And we have seven principles that we follow and believe in, but they're certainly not dogma or theology in any way. And I find them really refreshing to be principles that we can follow and think about, because a lot of people don't even have any principles in their life that they're actually trying to follow. Now, this particular principle is the following. It says, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Now, I was asked to do this morning, and I suspect it's because of my background. I'm a horticulturist, and I've always been interested in nature. So I decided this morning that what I'm going to do is talk about how important it is, the web of life. I'm going to talk a bit about the web of life, the details of what it is, and then I'm going to talk about how you can contribute to supporting it and preserving it by doing some new innovative things related to sustainability, composting, and recycling. By the way, this presentation was inspired by The Shared Pulpit, a course I'm taking with Karen. It's a really good book. Uh-oh. I put the wrong notes in here. Okay, I guess you're going to get the ad-lib version. Okay.
Well,
no, we didn't talk about that. Okay, you're going to get what I remember instead of what I'm going to read you. Okay, I think I'll do fine. Actually, you know, I think all of you probably know about the web of life. You probably have heard about it before, how, you know, we're connected to the plants because they produce oxygen and we breathe oxygen and we produce carbon dioxide and they use that. And the little creatures like insects and microbes decompose things that die and turn it into the earth so the plants can use the nutrients and all that stuff. You probably learned that in elementary school, so let's forget that. Also, I'm sure you know more about composting and recycling than I know, and you probably don't need to hear that one again. You don't need somebody preaching, you know, recycle. So I'm going to do something totally different. I'm going to tell you three stories this morning. My first story is the story about a person named Larry. Larry actually is going for a walk. He's walking through some long grass towards the forest because he wants to see what's going on in the forest. It's windy. The grass is almost to his knees. And it's a sunny day. He's really loving the sunshine and the breeze on this beautiful day. And as he gets closer, he realizes he can see these furry brown creatures jumping around in the trees. And when they stop, they chatter, and then they keep on jumping. And he loves seeing animals. Also, as he gets closer, he can hear the rush and gurgle of water, and he's curious how far away it is because he wants to go find it. As he walks through the grass, he stops because he suddenly sees what looks like three flowers. And so they're lit up by the sun. And so he gets down on his hands and knees and takes a look. And they're such beautiful flowers. Now, the first thing he does, which is what I would do, is sticks his nose in the flower to see what it smells like. But it doesn't have a scent. He's kind of surprised. But he looks at the flower and he thinks, they look familiar, but yet they kind of look different. I'm not quite sure what they are. Anyway, he gets up and continues to walk because he wants to get to the forest edge. And he's limited in time, so he's got to do it quickly. So as he continues to walk, he thinks about the life that's around him and the fact that it continues to grow and do its own thing without him. It doesn't really need him to do what it does. It just continues year after year to grow and perpetuate itself. And as the planet goes around and the sun comes up and goes down, life just continues. It doesn't really need him, but he really needs it because he appreciates everything he gets from the earth, if not just the oxygen that he breathes. Suddenly, though, he stops and looks down and realizes that he's wearing boots that most people wouldn't be wearing. And suddenly he realizes where he is. It's almost like he woke up from a dream. He realized that they've just arrived there on a spaceship, and it's their last possibility of surviving. He came on a spaceship from Earth. Earth now, unfortunately, is almost finished. The air's polluted, nature's been corrupted, and the authorities believe that there's no future for the planet. So their ship went out with a dozen people to try and find another home. Unfortunately, the first place they stopped was just a rock, a barren rock. It had oxygen and they could breathe it, but there wasn't much else there. No web of life, no soil to grow things in. So they moved on to another planet. They had three possibilities. The second one was completely covered with water. They couldn't even land. And while there may have been life in the water, it certainly wouldn't have been a good place to make a home. The third one they landed on actually had greenery and some blue color, which they expected was plants and water. So they landed there. And as he wanders around, he's pondering, we've got 2 years worth of food. There's 12 of us. We're not sure if we're going to survive, but we have to try, because this may be the last of humankind that survives in the universe. He looks around and realizes he doesn't even know if he's looking at summer or a place that has warm temperatures year-round. So he doesn't even know if they need to get ready for winter. He does know, though, that they better start cultivating the soil and growing their plants from seeds that they've brought with them and see if they can survive. He also looks around and sees animals that they may be able to use as food and other plants around that may, in fact, be food plants. But he also remembers that not all food plants can be eaten, or at least not all plants can be eaten. Some can be poisonous. And he's pondering how they can tell the difference. Anyway, this is Larry. He's pondering about the fact that they finally found a planet that has a living web of life that they really need, but it really doesn't need them. He also realized that there's a network of people that came with him, and they need each other so much. If they lost one of them, they would continue. So they need each other much more than the network needs them. My second story is about a woman. Her name is Sarah. She actually grew up in England, just outside of London. And she was born in the year 1775. I may get my dates wrong. Anyway, she married a fellow when she was in her early 20s, and he was in the military. It was a time when there was turmoil in North America. The British and the Americans were fighting shortly after that, after she got married. And her husband was sent to the U.S. As one of the British soldiers. At that particular point, it wasn't the U.S. yet. Anyway, they arrived just before 1776, and he was there posted with the British Army. She lived in Philadelphia with her aunt, and she waited as her husband was posted with the British troops as they were trying to win back the country and keep it for the crown. So she just stayed with her aunt. She was pondering about what was going to happen to her husband, and she was also looking after her young son at that point. He was just 18 months old. His name was John Jr. Her husband was John. After the Revolutionary War, their son got older, and the Americans basically took over, and anyone who was loyal to the crown were told to become Americans or leave. And so they had a choice. They could stay and become Americans, or they had to leave. So Sarah and her husband and their child decided they were going to go to Canada, because at least that area was still under the crown. So they packed up the few things they could take with them, and they got on a wagon with the rest of the Empire loyalists and left for the Niagara region. They arrived here in the mid-1780s. At this point, it was a few years after the war. Their son was actually growing up, and they had a second child at this point. Sarah was really concerned, because she knew that all that was there waiting for them was a piece of land that they were promised, help to get started to build a farm, and some food for a while until they got started. But she had never farmed. She didn't even know what a cow looked like. She knew how to sew. She knew how to cook. Cook food that she bought at the market. She only knew how to grow flowers in the house and in the backyard. She was really afraid of what she was going to find. And while her husband was really resourceful and had learned a lot of things in the army, he didn't know a lot about farming either. But it was certainly better than being with the rebellious people that had turned their backs on the crown. So they went, they traveled to this Niagara region that they'd never been to before, to a country that they really didn't know much about. And it was certainly a difficult journey. There weren't great roads. They were taking muddy trails through forests and swamps. Then they had to take a boat across the water to get to this new place called Upper Canada. Once they arrived, John got a ticket. It said he got 100 acres of land, and it was in a strange place called the 13. No, it was the 12. Sorry, it was the 12. It was also called Murray's Land. They weren't really too sure what that was. Sarah and John stopped at Fort George, which is right on the Niagara River, and she and her two children stayed there and waited. Because John took his ticket and went off with some of the other men to go find the land. The only thing he took with him, which was given to him, was an axe. She waited until he came back because his mission was to go build a house that they could live in. So off he went with the other men to a place called Murray's Land. She had heard other people scoff because the soldiers called it Murray's Land, after the fellow who actually was a soldier there, and he used to give food to the Empire loyalists. The locals called it St. Catherine's, a name she really didn't know. But apparently the land was close to there, and it was apparently a small village that few people lived in. Anyway, as she waited for 6 months. They got there in May. It was later on in the fall when he came back. He said that the house was finished, and if it wasn't for the fact that the locals helped him build his farm and cut down some of the trees, which if certainly they had to end up burning because that's all they could do to create some land, they had to cut the trees down first, he said, burn the stumps, then cut down trees to make the cabin. He said, you know, it's not going to be a great place, but it's at least home. It's made of logs. It's only 8 feet by 15 in length. It's one room, but at least it's got a roof on it. Unfortunately, we couldn't put windows in it, but we can do that later. If we need light, we'll just have to poke a few holes through the wood. There's actually lots of ventilation because we didn't quite get the logs close together. And I hate to tell you this, but the floor is just dirt. Maybe eventually we'll be able to build something better. So she got in a wagon and got to experience her new home. It certainly wasn't what she remembered in England. Beautiful trails through the forest, meadows and fields to walk in. It was these giant trees that invaded the trails, hung the trails, and if it wasn't mosquito-infested forest, it was swamp that they had to walk through or get through with their wagon or somehow get around it. So John and Sarah started their life. She realized, though, that she really needed to depend on the web of life that existed. They were really hoping for good crops. They were really hoping for rain. They hoped the soil was fertile and that nature would be kind to them because they really depended on the natural world to provide them their food. And so she really hoped that nature would be kind to them. She knew that nature didn't need them, but she certainly needed all the benefits from nature to help her out. She also hoped that there was a network of women around, because she knew nothing about farming. And she was really hoping there'd be some kind women around, a network of others that could help her learn what she needed to do to support her husband on this farm. Next, I'm going to read you a little bit from this book about what happened to Sarah and John. A few years later, at the close of the American Revolution, the British government determined to do all in its power to assist the Loyalist refugees and the disbanded soldiers to establish a home in Canada. For 3 years, there were to be provided with such rations as were allowed daily to a private soldier. And at the expiration of this period, it was presumed that they would be able to provide for themselves. They were also provided with spring wheat, peas, corn, and potatoes for seed. Government grist mills were constructed at Kingston, Niagara, and Napanee for their use. But at the end of the 3 years, they were still unprepared to support themselves. And as a season of drought and poor crops coincided with the end of the rationing system, a period of unparalleled hardship was the result. The year of famine, known to some as the scarce years, the hard summer, the starved years, was 1788. Through the distressed and through some districts continued until 1789. In the Niagara District, the drought and heat dried up wells and springs, and water was unobtainable at a distance from a lake or a river. Crops withered, cattle died. Game and wild birds practically disappeared, which, while frequent forest fires added to the trial of the inhabitants. Colonel John Clark of Niagara referred to this in his reminiscence as he wrote, "To use as food, we used roots and greens from the forest, and we made a kind of tea from the sassafras and hemlock leaves that were left." Captain James Derrick of St. Catharines recalls many details. "We noticed what roots the pigs ate, and by that means avoided anything that would have poisonous qualities, and dug for the same roots ourselves." He considered that the officers of the army did all in their power to mitigate distress, but the supplies were so limited, only small pittances were dealt out to the individuals. He further stated that dogs were killed to allay the pangs of hunger, the very idea bringing sickness to some, but others devoured the flesh quite ravenously and soon became used to the taste. His family was also to kill the horse that could not be spared for the farm work, but they had no other choice, eat the horse or starve. The horse lasted a long time and provided very profitable eating. In reminiscence by Egerton Ryerson and Thomas Merritt of St. Catharines, they stated that many family had no food left when the harvest was done. They were still 3 months away. No, it still had no food left, and the harvest was 3 months away. They ate leaves, ground nuts, herbs. They searched for fish, but they were hard to find. In the middle of June, they actually found that there was so much moss on the river, they couldn't even see the fish. Some settlers who had cows lived on milk for all meals until the wheat had headed sufficiently, whereupon they actually picked it before it was ripe and cooked it as food. During the winter, fishing was almost impossible, for the extreme cold froze up the lake and the river to a depth of 2 feet. It was cold like no other winter that we remembered in recent past. Powder and shot were scarce, and more game might have been obtained if we had more ammunition. Some of the inhabitants were so hungry that they did not wait to dress the game that they caught in snares. They roasted it as it was, and they ate fish only when they could get it, and unfortunately, if they found many, they would eat so much they would actually get ill. Children were sent to the forest to discover the storehouses the squirrels had created from the nuts they found, taking their stores from the winter. Catherine White states that the bullfrogs were eaten when provisions were scant, and potatoes which they were saving to actually plant had to be eaten as well. Some families had nothing to eat for weeks at a time but baked bran cakes from millet seed that was frequently substituted for wheat. References found that the food they ate was wild rice if they could find it, pigweed, lamb's quarters, ground nuts, and Indian cabbage. Others ate the bark of trees, the leaves, and the buds of the maples in the winter, beech, basswood, anything they found that had a vegetable quality they ate, hoping that they wouldn't actually die from the poison. A number of people died of starvation during this period of scarcity, while others met death as a result of eating poisonous roots or from disease. Fortunately, there was a network of people who worked together to support each other and help them through this very difficult time that happened on the very soil we're standing on. So that's the story of John, Sarah and John and their family who lived here. I have one more story to tell, and this is a story of a person named Walter. Trilogies are always more interesting. Walter is a fellow who just moved to St. Catharines, a new place. He was in a different place. He had a different job. And now he moved here. It was him and his cat. He didn't know anyone, and he was by himself. He tried to find friends because he knew that a network of friends would really be helpful, because he remembers what happened to him when he was in the last place he lived with the friends he had. Unfortunately, his two closest friends moved away and were still a phone call away, but not nearby. So he did everything he could to try and make some new friends, and while he made some acquaintances, that's all it ended up being. And a year passed by. He was starting to get worried because he knew that a network of friends would be valuable, and he really wanted to join a network of people that he could become part of. He really had lots to contribute, but really he needed their help. He remembers a couple of years ago when he had reacted to a medication he'd taken for a cold, and he was allergic to it, became paralyzed in pain, and physically could not move. If it wasn't for his roommate at the time, who actually called the ambulance, he's not really sure what would have happened. He may have just died there. His other real worry is that if anything ever happened to him when he's away, driving somewhere, if he got in a car accident, no one would know there was a cat at home that needed to be looked after while he was in the hospital or worse. He knew at least he needed some friends who knew his life, who could help him, and he was longing to join a network that he could contribute to as well. He needed this network so much more than they needed him. But he was so willing to contribute. But then he found out about a place called the Unitarian Congregation of Niagara. Some friends had told him about that and said he may be able to find some friends there. And he thought, well, he's tried everything else. He's got nothing to lose. So he dropped in. And to his surprise, instead of making a friend or two, all of a sudden he realized he was part of a network of people who were there willing to support him, and he was more than willing to give back. He was so amazed that he'd spent a year looking for one friend to mutually help him, and instead he found a whole family of people that love and help each other and don't even necessarily agree on a whole lot of things, but that doesn't cause a problem at all. So Walter was really quite excited to join a network of people. And just like the network of life that he was pondering when he was hiking on the trails, realizing the web of life that I know about really doesn't need me, but I need it. He also realized that network of people he met at the Unitarian Church. Certainly he needed it more than they needed him. And by the way, my middle name is Walter. Okay. So let's sing now. Oh, before that, it says questions and discussion. Does anybody have any questions or discussions about my presentation? By the way, I was faking it. I didn't really leave my notes at home. Go ahead.
I think, Dennis, since we've... Dennis Walter.
Yes.
That we need you too. We need you just as much as you need us.
And I appreciate that a lot. Okay, does anybody have any questions or comments? Okay.
How's the cat doing?
Cat's doing fine. Actually, my cat's Amber. She's my personal guard cat. She doesn't like most people, but she almost died 2 years ago. She was bleeding. When I picked her up, she was bleeding, and I'm thinking, cats don't bleed when they have their period. She wasn't fixed. And I found out that she, because she wasn't fixed as a house cat, her uterus was infected, which was very serious. They told me, do you want to put her down? Or do you want to pay $1,500 for the emergency surgery? It's your choice. I was in shock. She was my best friend, and I really didn't want to lose her. Unfortunately, I had a bit of an inheritance in the bank. And so at a time when I normally don't have much money, I had some. So I saved my best friend. She had the surgery. Her uterus had not burst, and now she's more full of life than ever. She's mellowed, and now she's gained weight because she's a little more mellow. She's still my best friend. She's 12. It's the first pet I ever had of my own that I got from a kitten, and the first time I've ever bonded with a pet in my life. So anyway, she's doing just fine. Doreen.
You're going to talk about things that we could do, which you haven't done yet.
I know, and I'm not planning on it, because I want you to think about what you can do. You don't need to be to talk about recycling and how to preserve the planet. I just wanted you to understand how important the web of life is to people in different situations. And not only how important the web of life is that we look after it, but also how important the network of people are. And the message I really wanted you just to remember, if nothing else, was the web will be fine without you. But, and it doesn't need you, whichever one it is, but you really need it. And you certainly can participate and give back, but you need it way more than it needs you, whether it's the web of life on the planet or the web of people that you know. Okay?
I was at a Christmas meeting of a group I belong to, the Niagara Restoration Council. They restore landscape beyond the Conservation Authority. And I was talking to some of the young people there and about their careers and their future. And it really bothered me a lot because I found that most of them are doing contract work. So that how can they plan family? And if the partner, husband or wife, is also on contract work and the contract that they take next year is in a different community, you know, there's a whole generation of young people out there who have none of the security that I have. I started a job in my 20s and I carried it on until I retired in my 50s in the same employer and all the benefits that come with it. These contract jobs do not have benefits. They do not have pensions. I mean, there's a whole generation of kids out there who are in a jungle economically and socially.
There certainly is, and that's one of the things I've noticed too, because fortunately I came through the same situation as you. I got a job when I came out of university. I had it for 20 years. Fortunately, I lost it, but found another one really quickly. It had pension, benefits, and the whole thing. And I see people around me, the jobs are switching to contract. And right now, a large percentage of the jobs that are out there, when the government says they're creating jobs, are creating part-time, low-pay jobs, especially in retail. And a lot of the big employers like Niagara Parks are doing the same thing. Instead of hiring a full-time permanent person with benefits and wages, they'll hire two or three part-timers making minimum wage. And it's just wrong, and it's something we need to fight for. And the reason it's happening is because it's cheaper. But not only is business doing it, I mean, they're obviously profit-motivated, but Niagara Parks is doing it, and they're not profit-motivated. They shouldn't be. And the government is doing it, again, to cut costs. But we've got to fight it, because we're going to have a generation of really poor people with no future, and the rich. And we need to fight it. The one thing that really bothers me at the Parks Commission, which I work at, and I actually only have a permanent full-time job because one opened that required a person who had experience in botanical garden records and museum artifact documentation and plant taxonomy. It was a very technical, very specialized job that I'd done for 20 years. Normally, you got to start as a seasonal, work at that for maybe 10, 15 years as a gardener, and maybe get a full-time job if one ever comes up. But usually when a full-time job is lost due to attrition, somebody leaves or they retire, they replace it with seasonal. The thing that really bothers me in the Parks Commission is a person who's a gardener as a seasonal gardener, starting in March, leaving usually October or November for the winter, they make a significantly less amount of money per hour than the full-timers, and I don't know how they get away with it. Because I always thought it was equal pay for equal work and pay equity. And it's something I'm concerned about there, too. I also used to work at Sobeys part-time as a cashier, and I got to work with people who had two or three part-time jobs. Their hours changed every week. It could be evenings, weekends, it could be all over the place. They were barely making ends meet. They had no pension, no benefits, and really a real crappy life. And I worked with those people, and the thing is, I would never even have socialized with that group. I appreciated so much being with them. I just needed the cash. But that's when it opened my eyes. The only full-time people in retail were the department managers. Everybody else was paid minimum wage. You got 10 cents an hour for 500 every 500 hours you worked, and they always gave the students or the new employees more hours than the ones that had been around for a while because they were cheaper. Isn't that scary? That's the way Sobeys and retail runs. Go ahead.
Yeah, and then if you finally make your way up, say, from $10 to $11,
mm-hmm.
with all the hours you put in,
yeah.
if the minimum wage then goes up from 10 to 11,
yeah.
you don't get 12. You
no.
stay at 11.
The other thing that stores do, like the Weston chains or grocery stores, you ever notice how they change their name? They go from Zayre's to Zayre's Supercenter or whatever. They do it on purpose. They manage the unions. Every group of stores has a different union, so they can't group together. Once the salaries in the store get to a certain point, they close the store. They renovate the store. They change the name of the store. They hire everybody back with zero seniority at lower wages. And then they do it again 10 years later. I know people who have experienced it three times. And now their salary is half of what they started with. And that's what the Weston chain does. They manage the unions to a point where their staff have no decent salaries. And the people have to stay because they've got no choice. So we've got to fight against this kind of thing. And this is a different issue. But anyway, that's another topic. And if you would like to have a presentation sometime about how you can protect the web, I'll get together with Joan and we'll give you lots of things that can be done. Or Jane, sorry, not Joan. You can help me too. Jane was sorry she couldn't be here today. Anyway, any more questions or discussion? Yes, at the back.
I just wanted to know, Dennis, how long were you in the hospital for?
I was in the hospital for a week. I had taken an antibiotic. I started to get nauseous about an hour later. I was throwing up, actually, about an hour after that. I was so weak when I was sitting in the bathroom, I physically couldn't help. I couldn't sit up on the tub. I had to support myself with my hands. Then I was still feeling so ill and so in pain, I laid on the floor in the hallway. Then I realized I couldn't get up. I was in so much pain. I finally struggled my way to get to the bed. I don't know how he did it. I kind of gripped my teeth. I have an extremely high tolerance for pain. But I was in a lot of pain. By the time the ambulance came to get me, because I actually got enough strength up to move my arm to hit the headboard to get my roommate to come and pay attention. It's all I could do. I couldn't move. When I got to the hospital, I was so paralyzed, and so much in pain, I was crying. I have a really high tolerance for pain. And as I said, I was there in eMERGE for a week. Until the pain disappeared. They actually had me on morphine at one point. They still don't know what happened, but they had me on huge painkillers. And then when they switched the antibiotics in the middle of the night, I got an allergy reaction to it to make it even more fun. I started to get itchy. But anyway, that's another story. Sometime I'll have to tell you about all the things I heard and all the adventures the staff had when people came into emergency in the middle of the night. Oh my goodness, that was an adventure. Anyway, but I always think about what would happen to my cat if I'm gone for a week. Fortunately, I had a roommate. Anyway, that's another story for another time.
Was it an antibiotic?
It was. It was, and it was just the pain spiked to the point where I couldn't move. And so nobody really knows what it was. They don't know whether it was allergy or what it was, but I just can't go near it. Never had a reaction like that before in my life.